Accession number 20513, reel 6.
And all that's on reel 6.
Yeah, I think the cost could have been much higher, and was in fact rather less than we had been basing our calculations on. It was an affair that demanded all our attention and got us very, very involved. It was also an interesting sort of military problem that we were operating a fleet at enormous long lines of communication. I mean, they set up what they call the M1 motorway, running the supply ships down to Ascension and then from Ascension down to the Falklands, and then the RFAs were taking fuel from merchant tankers and putting it into the ships, keeping the fleet at sea in southern latitudes, which was by this time approaching the depth of the Antarctic winter. Troops who, if they are to retain battle fitness, can't be kept cooped up in ships for too long. And some of whom, other than the Marines, were not used to being cooped up in ships anyway. Our comparatively small air assets, I mean, the Sea Harrier was a fantastic performer. I know that Sharkey Ward complains about the way they were used, and I'm not an aviator, so I won't think, but the Sea Harrier pilots did a fantastic job, including those RAF pilots who flew their planes out to join them. But the thing was that if you try and get ashore too soon before you've softened up the Argentine forces, which in essence was their ability to fly air attacks on you, you would have a debacle. On the other hand, we couldn't delay too long because there would have been a time at which our chaps were getting tired and we couldn't have any fresh reserves to put into the battle. The illustrious, I think it was the second carrier, was still not ready to take over from the Invincible. So it was, we reckon that end June, early July was the latest date by which we could possibly go ashore. And if we were delayed the landing after that, we might have to reconsider the whole business. So we had to have this deadline, and in fact, of course, we got ashore in earlier than that, in May. But the general impression was, I think, that once we got our troops ashore and we didn't have a sort of ANZIO, and I know Admiral Fieldhouse was very concerned, and we did speak about this, that once we got ashore we should exploit the landing as quickly and as resolutely as possible, because an amphibious landing sometimes can peter out. The troops are so glad to be ashore safely that they then take a deep breath and relax, and had to push on. In fact, the Argentine reaction was pretty slow, but we reckon once we got these troops ashore, let's face it, the commando brigade, two battalions of paratroops, Gurkhas, a couple of guards regiments, the Argentine crack troops who spearheaded the invasion had gone, and the occupying force was a lot of conscripts who were not particularly well armed, not particularly well motivated. And let's face it, the only experience of action that the Argentine forces has had was putting down insurgent demonstrators in their own country, and fighting a lot of commandos in the thing is very different from tackling a few trade unions in the streets of Buenos Aires. So I believed, certainly, and I think I was right, that once we got engaged in the land battle, we would win. The one thing that upset this to a degree was the loss of the Atlantic conveyor, where the Chinook helicopters went down, and so we had to do a lot more marching, which was where, of course, the paratroops and the commandos came into their own, because they were super fit. But as it happened, it might have been a close-run thing, but once the scales had tipped, it didn't become a close-run thing at all. It became merely a matter of how soon are the Argentines going to surrender. I must say their air force fought desperately hard up to the end, but they had quite severe losses. I can't remember the full statistics, but they had severe losses from planes. Some of their sorties, you know, they were losing 50% of the chaps. Well, you can't sustain that sort of record. And, of course, to avoid the fleet's long-range radar, they were coming in very low over the sea for the last time. And I've read reports to say that when they got back to their bases, you know, they were covered with salt from flying so low over the sea. And by the time they got to the Falklands, they only had about 2 minutes excess time, so it was a question of come in, bomb and go. They couldn't afford to get involved in a dogfight or anything, or to spend much time choosing targets. There's a British ship, let's attack it, almost was the thing. I think also they concentrated rather more on the warships, whereas if they'd have bombed the Canberra, it would have been horrific. But they were very brave, but they were pretty much, you know, like British. They had all the virtues, the old British sort of cavalry almost, you know, gung-ho polo players they were. Very brave. But we were, our defences, I think, were just good enough to prevent them ever achieving the superiority which they would have needed to prevent our reinvasion succeeding.
Any comments on the submarine war?
Now, the submarine war, our submarines, the main objective of our submarines, although one or two of the conventional submarines did actually land special forces on one or two occasions, which was very valuable. But the nuclear submarines were designed to prevent the Argentine fleet being deployed in an area where they could engage us. And there's been a lot talked about the Belgrano, and a lot of nonsense being talked, dare I say it. The background to this is that, for political reasons largely, our rules of engagement had been gradually extended to give our forces more freedom of action. I mean, it was the inevitably, the rules of engagement were a compromise between Sandy Woodward and his chaps who wanted full freedom to do anything, and the political need to keep the Americans offside and always seem to have the white hat on, if you get what I mean. So we had to give freedom of action for our forces to take aggressive rather than defensive action in a gradually expanding range, both of area geographically and range of activity. And what finally relaxed it completely was the intelligence we had that three groups of Argentine ships were approaching the Falkland Islands. There was the carrier and its escorts to the north, and another group of ships, and there was the Belgrano and her escorts to the south. And the British submarines were deployed to try and detect these fellows. And we then got approval that the enemy warships were to be attacked anywhere, virtually, outside Argentine territorial waters. because we didn't want, you know, if the carrier was coming down, we didn't want to say, well, we won't attack you until you're in a close enough to damage us. And it was the carrier we were really hoping to get. As it happened, the submarine that was due to track the carrier lost contact. I'm not sure that wasn't Lane Knott's submarine up to the north. But in fact, the carrier had had problems which we didn't know about with its flight deck equipment, and it turned round. The Belgrano, on the other hand, was still manoeuvring around to the south, and we were worried, and they were worried, and Sandy Wood was worried, that if it went over the shallow water of the Birdwood Bank, it could quite possibly lose contact with the Conqueror. And as is usual in a ship in those situations, it was steering irregular courses. But it was close enough to our task force to present a certain threat, although she was an old ship. She still had long-range guns, which could have done quite a bit of damage had she been properly fought. And anyway, we didn't selectively things. I mean, the idea is Mrs. Thatcher said, sink the Belgrano. No, it was rather more prosaic than that. You have freedom of action to engage enemy warships in the following areas of the South Atlantic. You know, blah, blah, blah. And it just so happened that the Belgrano happened to be in, well, the Conqueror was in contact with the Belgrano when this freedom of action came. And to the captain of the Conqueror, this was an enemy ship. And, the idea that she was at the time of the attack steering towards Argentina, there was no intention he intended to return there. She might have been altering course for any reason. So he attacked her and sank her, and then went away. And as far as I know, the Argentine captain of the Belgrano stated publicly that he didn't see anything dastardly at all in that. Perhaps he was a bit incompetent, perhaps he was unlucky, but he lost. I say the argument that you should never engage a chap that's going away would meant that half the German planes that were shot down during the Battle of Britain should have been allowed to get home. You know, they dropped their bombs on London. They're going back to France, therefore we shouldn't shoot them down, which is an argument I find hard to sympathise with. What it certainly did, the sinking of the Belgrano, was to completely paralyse any aggressive mentality in the Argentine Navy. And from that time on, they wanted out. So that was our submarine activities. We were worried that the Argentine submarines would pose a threat. And there were one or two in the area, but they never really made full use of their capability. And some of them, of course, were still in harbour at a time when their presence in the area could have been very embarrassing indeed. There was one submarine went to South Georgia and got attacked and sunk, the Santa Fe. I think it did demonstrate how effective nuclear submarines can be against surface ships, though you wouldn't expect any redoubtable navy to behave as perhaps incompetently as the Belgrano did. But as I say, as the officer who approved the rules of engagement sent them off to Terry Lewin, I could not be any party to this idea that it was some sort of personal vendetta by the Prime Minister, of whom politically I'm not a great admirer, for the record. But in that occasion, I just think any criticism of her is totally unjustified. And I think the answer is that we won. People ask me occasionally, somebody asked me the other day, whether we could fight a similar sort of campaign today with the reductions that have taken place since 1982? The answer is that, of course, the capability of our ships has improved tremendously, but presumably the capability of a potential enemy might have as well. And I think on a question of sheer numbers, and in particular the numbers of merchant ship support, we would have difficulty in fighting that sort of campaign so far away from home. I think that the arguments against action would be far stronger and more difficult to rebut than they were in 1982. Because quality of ships matters, but numbers of them matters also. And we undoubtedly have cut down the size of our fleet tremendously. I say that the Falklands was virtually my last time, and within 6 months of the Falklands being over, again the discussions were out as to can we start reintroducing defence cuts, perhaps not quite as swinging as John Knotts had envisaged, but it was certainly a question of the sort of death of 100 knives almost in for the last 27 years, long time ago now, 17 years, the last 17 years it's been very much a question of gradual reduction in the size of the fleet, though the capability of individual units has improved. There's no doubt about it. Couple of memories of the Falklands. The thing is, before the war started, but I was at a meeting with the Secretary of State and one or two other civil servants, somebody from the Foreign Office, about the situation regarding the deployment of our submarines to the South Atlantic, when the division bell sounded and off he dashed. And the telephone rang, so the private secretary said, "I think it's you'd better answer this." And this was the whip's office to say that the First Sea Lord, in uniform, was in their office demanding to see the Prime Minister. And eventually he did see the Prime Minister. This was to agree to preparing a task force in the event that the negotiations did succeed. I think it was on the Thursday before the Wednesday or Thursday before the invasion. He'd been actually carrying out an inspection at HMS Dryad, which is why I was in uniform. He'd come back and they said, "You know, this is your bit. You better rescue your First Sea Lord from the whip's office." I could say it was necessary because the whips had got a bottle of whiskey on the table. And the other one was when the SAS party on South Georgia got into trouble and had to be evacuated from the glacier, and the first two helicopters we sent to rescue them both crashed, and I had to tell the Chief of the Defence Staff this about half an hour before John Knott was due to make a statement in the House on the progress of events, which was not going to be a very cheerful announcement. And I broke the bad news, went back to my office, and after 10 minutes I got a phone call from Admiral Halifax at Northwood to say that a third helicopter had loaded itself completely over capacity with not only the SAS people but also the crews of the other two helicopters, you remember the case, and had got them back safely. So I put on my running shoes and I caught the Chief of the Defence Staff and John Knott as they were leaving the Ministry of Defence to go to the House of Commons. I was able to tell them that there was no need to do this. the less comforted moments was when we heard of the loss of the Sheffield and the Atlantic conveyor. I think they came as more of a shock because they were the first. They were the demonstration that the Argentines had the Exocet working, which was a bit of a blow because we'd been assured that they weren't ready to be used by our intelligence people. And that, of course, once the invasion had started, you were more steeled for losses. Whereas at that time, we were not quite ready for them, I think. And that was my naval service. I then sat on the committee on the protection of military information in wartime, chaired by Hugh Beach, the last first month as a naval officer and later as a retired naval officer. And that was interesting in that it obviously showed that our current growth of communications is making censorship as we used to know it virtually impossible. I mean, in the Second World War, it was quite easy to stop all contact between America and Britain. We shut off about 4 telephone exchanges on the Atlantic cable. Nowadays, of course, practically anybody can talk to anybody all over the world using satellites. And also, I think the attitude of the media since Vietnam has been very much against what they see as interfering with their freedom to report freely and impartially. And I think as far more of the wars, trouble, that our forces are engaged in these days and probably in the future, are unlikely to involve the survival of our country, I think the press will be less inclined to adopt the supportive role that undoubtedly they did in the Second World War. I mean, if giving the German side of the case is going to mean that you're going to be put in a concentration camp because we've lost the war, you're more inclined to be, say, patriotic or restrictive in what you say than if you think it's merely going to bring down a government of which you may or may not approve. So,
how do you feel now about your many years in naval service?
I don't regret it at all. Whether I could have done some jobs better or worse, I don't know. I undoubtedly, in terms of promotion, I succeeded far better than my wildest dreams when I first joined. You know, I thought, well, if I become a commander, I'd have done very well indeed. So I can't say that by the lights of this world I failed in my profession. I found it rewarding. I like sailors. I find they're infuriating. Infuriating and, dare I say it, lovable, you know.
What's so infuriating about them?
Oh, they're bigoted, conservative, awkward. In fact, they're human beings. But at the same time, you develop a great affection for them. And I feel, and I know a lot of senior officers who share my opinion, that those of us who've managed to rise to certain heights in the service should always be very grateful for the support we've had and the loyalty we've had from chaps who've never risen very high indeed. And so I think every senior officer is in the debt of his ratings. I hope that some ratings feel they're in the debt of their senior officers.
What do you think about the question of women going to service?
Well, I think with modern trends in the Navy generally, I think they always say that armed forces must reflect the society which they serve to protect. I think it was in some film I saw when some American gung-ho colonel said that He was in the Marines to defend democracy, not to practice it. But I think I am wary, I shall say no more, about some of the measures which are designed to bring a measure of, quote, political correctness, unquote, into the conduct of the armed forces. The armed forces in a democracy obviously must be a reflection of the values of that society. But on the other hand, the armed forces have to accept certain restrictions on personal liberty in order to do their job. And I think, as General Hackett once said, it's this sort of the unlimited liability extended by a soldier or sailor's contract or an airman's contract, which means that, you know, like Lloyd say, you can be had for your last shirt button. The soldier or sailor or airman can be had down to his life. That's what Il Volta is offering his boss. And so, to a degree, it is and must be different. And I think that in accepting too much the very desirable, in some ways, features of civilian society, the armed forces may be reducing their effectiveness to defend that society. I mean, one of the things presumably a soldier fights for is the right to put yourself first and make a profit, or the right to go on strike if you don't like the conditions of service. I think the soldier, and some aspects of the public service have the same, hospitals, I suppose, but the soldier or the sailor, while he may say these are worth defending in the society as a whole, can't expect them to be applied to his own conditions of service. Otherwise, his ability to protect those values would suffer. And I know that we are having trouble in recruiting. This is one of the reasons why they get Wrens. But I am not convinced that when action is really joined and casualties are being suffered, a unit which includes women in the front line would fight as well. Not because I don't think the women will fight as well, but I think the men might suffer morale problems.